You want the middle name?
As if I am the student from the 70s.
Like no, no, playing, no.
Which I can do.
Oh my, no, no.
Living at Hedrick
just
Hall.
Say your name, how old you are. Well, I'm going to say today I'm interviewing on August 17th or 18th? 18th. Okay, 18th. August 18th, 2019.
Well, that puts me over my birthday.
And we are in Montecito, California. And everyone just say your names and your age.
Hi, I'm Diana. I'm 65.
All right, do you want her whole name? Entire name?
Sure.
I'm Robert Isley, and I'm 71.
Hi, I'm Walter Davis. And there's a dispute as to my actual age.
I'm Richard Rinaldo, and I'm 72.
Great. Okay, but y'all's full names I already put in the data. Okay. Uh-huh. So don't have to worry about that. And like I said, they cleaned it up. Okay, so when and how did y'all meet?
Oh, dear.
Well, who's
who met first?
Who met first?
I met myself first.
Yeah, where did you? Were you guys before us?
I met Walter in 1973 or 74, because he had just done a project for a friend of mine, and it was actually a brilliant piece of writing. And he was walking with another mutual friend of ours, Ed Kamara, and. Ed, I was actually walking with Ed, it seems to me, and he introduced, no, I was with you, and you introduced me to Ed. And Ed recognized a certain name, which I'm not accustomed to having recognized. And
is that Ed, UCLA?
That was at UCLA.
Yeah.
Yes.
What's Kamara?
Kamara is a Russian.
A Russian?
His name, Ed is a Russian, Kamara is a Russian name. And
it means dark cloud, and he was not a dark cloud guy, but he was a little pessimistic, and he's still around.
Okay, so the Russians brought you together during the Cold War.
Yeah, no, he was American, though. He was born here. His parents were
okay. Getting off the rails here.
Sorry, how did y'all meet?
Walter Davis and I were in a playwriting class studying for our Masters of Fine Arts at UCLA in 1972 to 74, and I think I met him in 72. In the class, and he had a play done called Panhandle, which I had heard of and liked the idea of, and I was impressed. I shouldn't have been, no, I'm teasing. I was impressed, and he was also older than me. He's still old. That's why I call him Funky Unk. No. So Walter, had been in the Navy and, you know, done a few things in his life, and I was, still fresh out of undergrad school, so we were both a couple of ex-jocks, and we were progressives. We were anti-war activists, and yet we were also guys that could tussle with cops if we had to. And we kind of bonded on that level, and our writing, basically. Mm. We were both budding playwrights.
And what about this beautiful woman? When did you come in?
Well, I do have to say that their playwriting instructor said that particular year was this group of young writers was the best he'd ever had in terms of talent. So they were all together and writing together. Me, I was a dance student, and I wandered up to the theater department where Bob here was a theater and film student, and he was a teaching assistant and was teaching a short unit on stage combat. And I needed three units, so I thought, well, I could probably handle that for 6 weeks. So I wandered up there, and there he was doing stage combat and his karate, and just to make it short, at the end of the unit, we had to each go up with the instructor and spar for about half a minute. And I kicked him in the ass. And we exchanged numbers.
I mean, you still are.
Yeah. I'm still kicking my ass.
I'm still kicking his ass. 44 years.
That's great.
a typical Hollywood marriage. She was a professional dancer, and I'm a screenwriter, and I was a playwright. I'm a published poet, and we've been together for 44 years, so I like to be
ironic. Well, we waited 10 years to have children, which is probably why we're still together.
Yeah.
We're having fun.
And a typical is, of course, ironic because Hollywood is filled with fractured relationships.
Right. Well, Diane, what did you think of this crew?
Quite remarkable. Always writing, poetry, really great talents. Yeah. Who else was in that group? Steve Brown. Ed Kamara.
Lou Kolick.
Uh-huh.
Brandis.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, David
when
Brandis.
When did Larry come into y'all's line?
Larry who?
Larry Tuch. It was later.
That's SB years.
Yeah, he was in UCLA.
Well.
But anyway, a great group.
That's a meandering story because I met Larry first at UCSB.
Ah.
Right, because UCSB was first for
but
you.
But Larry's not here. He can't get interviewed.
Too bad, Larry.
So talk about us, Walter.
Should have come. Died a pack.
Okay, what was L.A. like at that time?
You could have a cheap apartment and for $300 and sleep on the floor and work at Rexall Drugs and move furniture and be happy.
CeCe Brown's was in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah.
The absolute most fabulous hot fudge sundae ever.
But what did we say? They all look like moles.
They look like lymph nodes of people that work there.
But the family, they're just overabundantly eating ice cream. The family just...
Well, let's not be...
But anyway, lobby so, with ice cream.
So, but what's interesting is that was also a time when there was there was a lot of racism in Los Angeles. Mm. And I was in the 1965, I was selling shoes in downtown LA as a kid, and I saw, Jeeps with 50 caliber machine guns in back coming down South Broadway, and I thought, well, this must be a movie or something. And it was beginning of the Watts riots. And then, unfortunately, I think there was, and I'm, by the way, I have cop friends, so I'm not against police at all, even though I said that stuff, because we were anti-war activists, so you'd get, it would be tussles. But what was curious then was how above board it was. I used to go fishing with a LAPD guy that I liked, and then there was a Black Panther out in front of the shoe store, and he started tuning up the Black Panther for no reason. The kid had done nothing. And I ran out, and I said, "Andy, what the fuck are you doing?" And he says, "You want some of this?" And he holds up his baton like he's gonna hit me in the face, and I didn't want to go to jail. And he just was beating this kid because he didn't like his politics and his color. Mm-hmm. So there was that. That was how LA was. That's one in one way how LA is different today. We might still have it, but at least it's not something that you can wear on your sleeve as a good thing.
Right.
You know. But LA was, it's a lot like it was today, filled with Hollywood and filled with illicit drugs.
What about hippies? Hippies?
There was a lot of So I guess we could qualify it as hippies, right?
Yeah, they were on the way out.
In the 70s, yeah. Because I guess after the Manson family murders, it took the blush off the rose, you know? I guess that was at 69. And but what we did have was, there was never a summer of love here like there was in San Francisco. It wasn't quite the same thing. But when people talk about the divisions in the country today, it was probably just as bad back then. It was more generational division, but it was, we've waxed and waned in our unity as a country, and I think that we were kind of at polar opposites there, a lot of us, but we came back together again.
What about politics? Did y'all talk when you were young people amongst yourselves about politics a lot, or was it mostly art and writing?
Plenty of politics. You're a fucking fascist.
You sound like Jack.
Yeah.
Who's a fascist?
Yeah.
What do you say, Richard? You haven't said anything in a while.
Well, I would say that, yes, we talked about politics because that was part of what bound us all together. The other thing that bound us together was I had a shack up in Laurel Canyon. It was the music era. I had no idea who my neighbors were, Stephen Stills and people of that kind. And Walter needed a place to live, so he came and he was my roommate for a while until he sold his first screenplay, which was an extraordinary experience, wasn't it?
Did you live near Cielo Drive?
Did I live near?
Cielo Drive.
No, I was in Laurel Canyon in off Weepaw Way.
It's Benedict Canyon.
That's Benedict Canyon.
So tell us, Walter, tell us about the politics back then.
Or tell us about the women. Were y'all like chasing women all the time?
Who isn't at that age?
But was it different?
I thought they were more chasing us. But
well, what about your draft numbers?
Oh.
Well, yeah, it was a time.
That got you together.
See, they took, I was raised in the San Gabriel Valley in Altadena, California, which was, you know, it's actually was then and is now very diverse, but until the Civil Rights Act in 65, there was redlining, and so there were white neighborhoods and black neighborhoods all over America, not just in, you know, in the Deep South. People don't know that, or they forget it, you know, because banks wouldn't loan and insurance companies wouldn't give home insurance if you were black trying to move into white neighborhood. But I lived in the last white neighborhood on the edge of a black neighborhood, so as a writer, I've written a lot of stuff that has diversity and mm-hmm. deals with a lot of different racial interactions. It's because of where I was raised and the people I knew. And also my family is now very diverse and integrated. But what was interesting is that the, you know, basically there was a common culture of music that brought a lot of people together. And that started to break down color lines too. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, white kids love Motown, you know, and black kids didn't love the Beatles, but they would kind of, it was a guilty pleasure for them because their music was really colorful. Yeah, well, the Beach Boys were actually quite musically interesting too. They did some good stuff, but I think I'm meandering. I don't know what I
would point. Well, that's you.
Well, thank you. That's just the woman that's been with me for 44 years. But I think music brought us together. She asked about draft numbers. That's what it was. We all of us, you know, I think Michael, was it David Hare or Michael Hare, the writer
David.
That wrote about Vietnam.
I think David.
David Hare. I'm sorry. Yeah, he said that instead of happy childhoods, we had Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And what it did was this, is that it was a war that we now, you know, since look at, and we think that it was a war that was did not have to be waged. You know, the men that fought there and the women that fought there, you know, really, God bless them. I mean, they should be honored. But it was a tough time. And when I was young, I went to an all-boys Catholic high school football factory, and I thought I should be a commie killer, and I wanted to enlist, but I was, at the time, a weightlifter and a little bit, because of the weightlifting, over the weight, and they wouldn't take me. And then after I started getting radicalized in college, and I had my friends coming home dead, or a lot of them had PTSD. And I started examining the politics and the so-called, we were dying for a theory called the domino theory, that the Chinese and Russians would take us over if we didn't defend every last stanchion of, you know, of democracy in the world, and of course that proved not to be the case, but at the time we didn't know. I understand why there was a certain
failed theory,
a very failed theory, but we all had the draft and hanging over our head, and that is what fueled the anti-war movement.
Except for me.
That's right. You did go in. Well, you can speak to that in a moment.
This is for you.
But what happened?
Right, there's tears.
But what happened was, you know, Nixon was clever. Because he realized how he could short circuit the anti-war movement, just pull the plug right out from all the energy.
I'd like to say this about that.
Yes, is that what he would? That sounds like Nixon. What he decided to do was to get a lottery system, and the lottery system is 365 days of the year. And if you came out, as number one, June 8th came out number one in the first lottery. My birthday is June 9th. And mine came out, I think, number 362. So the number one guy, he gets drafted, and I'm saved from the draft. So all of a sudden, people stop marching. The ones from, you know, you were either in going to war, or you weren't going to go to war, or you maybe would go to war. Mm-hmm. So it really, you know, was a very clever political move. It was a period where, do you want to go and fight in a war that isn't just? That's how we felt.
Mm-hmm.
There's a different, the first just war in my life was going into Afghanistan after 9/11. That is a just war. Mm-hmm. We needed to go in there. We didn't need to necessarily stay in there or go into Iraq. That's a different story.
Right.
But when those men and women went in to find Osama bin Laden, that is justified. That's when you take military action, not misadventures.
And I do want to say something too, and that is, I think it was very common at that time to be aware that Vietnam was a war that we could never win politically. We could win maybe military. We could not win politically. This was not a war that we could be involved in. And so many of us were being asked to go and do our duty and give up our lives. It was apparent, even then it was apparent, that it was not appropriate for us.
But what was ugly though, I remember being in a bar and people were calling a serviceman a child killer and stuff. And I stood up with him and I told him to go fuck themselves. Because I was never against the boys in Vietnam, I was against the boys in Washington. Mm. It was what LBJ was doing and after him, R.M. Nixon. They were unconscionable. Nobody wanted to, especially with Nixon, he didn't want to lose a war. So he made it go on for years after, and it didn't have to, you know.
So y'all didn't have a pass being in college?
A what?
A pass.
Nope.
You mean a deferment?
You did early on. Early on, it was a 2S. You had a student deferment. They got rid of them, and they put in the lottery.
Oh.
Goodness. Yeah.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. Going.
And also, it wasn't fair. Yeah. It wasn't fair going to college. Why, so you ship only the working class kids.
Well, it was, right. That
yeah,
was
and I come from the working class, but I was smart, so I could go to college.
It's always been that way.
But yeah. Oh, by the way, back then, I want you to know, UCLA, back then, when I started out, was $80.50 a quarter. And then it went up to $109.50 by the time I graduated.
And I paid $208.50.
Yeah, so it just, she's younger than us. And so, but now, it's so, everything's gotten, the fact that we have lost the commitment for free education,
yeah,
and that we have lost the commitment for, you know, helping people, you know, with housing, you know, and stuff like that. It's a little scary, but
actually that would be a great question if we could remember what was the tuition in 1973 or 72
there
at UCLA. What was your tuition?
$208.50 a quarter.
$208.50 a quarter.
Uh-huh.
And when I went there in 67, it was $80.50. I remember that, absolutely. Yeah. $80.50 a quarter.
Yeah. Walter, what about your draft experience?
Yeah, how did you get in the Navy, brother?
You enlisted, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, there was a program the Navy had that would pay for my going to a four-year college.
The GI Bill from the
It
World
was
War?
Not the GI Bill. It was called the Naval Scientific Education Program.
Okay.
The idea was to get some Navy officers who would be committed, you know, for an ungodly number of years for getting, you know, a free education from the point of view of tuition and all those costs.
But not to make light of it, you're the only man I know who can chop a chicken. You said you learned it in the Navy. In fact, I said it to you the other way. I'm trying to cut the drumstick. I said, shit, Walter's the only one who knows.
He could debone a chicken.
Right.
That's what they call in the Navy.
Right?
Yeah,
because nice
I was
going to
say, you bring chicken.
Yeah.
I could get a whole chicken in less than 5 minutes.
Yeah, he's the only one who does.
No, by the way, to just quantify one thing, when I was talking about
I don't know if I believe that.
Being a 220-pound weightlifter, somebody hears this, they're going to say, well, they would take a weightlifter at 220, but I was like 5'8". And back before the Tet Offensive, and I had some chunk on me, I wasn't all muscle, but they didn't care if it was fat or muscle, you had certain height things with weight things. After the Tet Offensive in 67, they'd take anybody.
Because of the uniforms, they were trying to save money on
No, that's cute. No, the reason is that before the Tet Offensive, we didn't need as many men. They weren't pouring, it wasn't like just pouring bodies over there to fight. Before the Tet Offensive, and then by that time, you know, the physicals, they were taking almost everybody, except for Commander Captain Bone Spurs, you know, Mr. Trump. I mean, the reality of it is that rich guys.
Please don't start.
I'm going to just say this.
Let's
rich.
Have a question.
I don't have different interview.
I don't have the strength.
No, but rich guys. No, this is not about him now. He's of our generation. He's 2 years older than me. He's 3 years younger than this guy, and about the same age as this guy. The reality of it is that in our generation, rich guys had doctors and lawyers and got out.
Mm-hmm.
Working class kids like Walter and me didn't. And I was just luck of the draw that I didn't go. Because when I wanted to enlist, they wouldn't take me. And then when I didn't want to go, along came
The lottery.
Yeah.
Is one of your questions about what made us go to film school? Or how did we get into film school?
Yes. Somewhat like that.
Thank you.
Why don't we do that question first? So, why did y'all want to go to film school?
Let's start with Walter, because I look
apart. Because I loved movies. When I was a kid in Compton, I used to walk all by myself when I was in the first grade and even the year before, which was the kindergarten year on paper, but they said I didn't need to come for that. But I would walk from where I lived on Slater Avenue over to where the movie house was Saturday afternoons, and they had a whole kids program. They did a bunch of cartoons. They did a serial about a submarine that was preparing to go to war with the Germans.
Ooh.
And so anyway, we managed to get to the theater. And if you could arrive with a full quarter, you could get in for 15 cents. And with the 10 cents left over, you could get a popcorn and a drink.
What year was that?
1948.
Wow.
Well, it's a while ago.
Okay, my next question is...
Don't you say why I got into film school?
Right.
Yeah. No.
Okay, I talked to you.
Can you describe one of your... Well, I'm just trying to keep it focused a little bit. Can you describe one of your favorite memories from when y'all were friends in college? Like, what's a funny night or experience? Just anything that stands out as really special.
Well, I'd like to answer that because it was my friend Guy who...
Guy?
Yes, his name is Guy Prevost. He's a also a film student, and he had a screenplay that he'd gotten a grant for, but it wasn't quite right, and he had Walter rewrite it, and I saw a miracle happen within the writing,
mm-hmm.
and it just came alive.
Wow.
And it was my first experience of seeing just how powerful words properly used can become.
Wow.
So that was my introduction to Walter.
Walter, what's one of your favorite memories from college? Or, well, I guess graduate school.
From film school?
From film school with your buddies here.
Hmm. Well... There was this one girl on the crew.
It's always a girl.
Ah, here we go.
Who?
You're getting that twinkle, Walter.
She was rather well built. And
a handsome woman.
A handsome woman. She wore this very loose...
Walter, it's me too. You gotta watch it now.
It was a very you were there?
You wanted to know the story just, between y'all. Yeah. What's
Where was no, I? No, yeah, the slinky dress lady is good, but I want a story like of y'all.
Well, that, I think that is.
Well, let's think. How about, let me just think of a couple of things here.
Shall I blow anything up?
No, we didn't blow anything up, but I do.
There was some of that in the back.
There was.
I remember somebody sideswiped my mother-in-law's car, and Walter and I chased him and scared the living hell out of him. But that wasn't, we found
him. Oh, I have a story.
What?
But I don't think you were there, but others at UCLA were there.
Yeah, but that's doesn't oh, yeah. take
it
in
doesn't
this
okay. pertain to film
school. Well, you can tell it if you want.
Pertains to UCLA. So Bob and I had been dating, but in the summers, the fraternities would rent rooms to girls for cheap, like $40. And my friend and I wanted to stay in LA to continue our ballet classes. So we stayed at this fraternity called Sigma Nu.
Yep.
Ugh, I dated a Sigma Nu.
Yeah, okay, so here comes the story. So one night, they all got drunk. They lived in a beautiful old house on Strathmore. It was an old, beautiful Spanish house that was a fraternity, and they had a huge stained glass picture window. They all got drunk, and they took their couch, and they threw it through the glass, and the one guy had the ring of keys to the room, and he went like this. He shook them, and he said, "Girls, we have the keys. You better run."
The keys to their rooms, where they were, which they were renting for the summer.
Oh my God!
Right, we're staying there as residents. So we had just been dating. So we didn't know what to do. We all ran to our rooms and locked the shitty lock, you know. And I called him. I didn't have anybody else to call. I called him on the rotary phone.
Mm-hmm. Who is Hims?
And I said, "Listen, I don't know what's going on here, but this is the situation." And he said, "Stay right there. We're coming." So who came? He came. Jim Nader, UCLA quarterback, came. And his brother Dick, that we still call Big Dick. Okay.
My brother Dick, not yes. Jim Nader's.
Yes. Yes. Right. So they all came, and it was all a blur, but after the blur, he said, "Get your stuff. You're coming with me."
And you've been that lived was together ever since.
Can I tell the blur? My brother Dick was when he was lean, he was 250 pounds. He was the only white man I know built like a Samoan. He was about 6'2". And I was only 5'8 and a half, but I weighed about 200 pounds. And then our quarterback, Jim Nader, who got signed to the Atlanta Falcons but never made it and later had a schizophrenic break. He's dead now. He's a wonderful guy. But he had mental illness. But yeah. But Jim was about almost 6'3 and weighed about 215. And he had fists on him like boulders.
And he was gorgeous, and he was like the brother I never had.
But he was a guy that was really a great quarterback too. He had real athleticism. So the three of us basically, we never liked frat boys much, partly because of their politics, partly because, you know, they were the opposite of me too. I mean, they would do things. They were bullies with women. I never liked that, you know.
And neither of the three of you would turn down a fight.
Well, the reality.
Especially your brother.
Well, no, the reality of it is, well, Dick was terrifying, you know, to look at him. But the reality of it is that the three of us were able to stand down about 25 guys, you know. And not because we're such badasses, but because we had fury. And we were righteous. They were wrong.
They were drunk too.
And they knew they were wrong. And they're also, you learn something about crowd control. Crowds aren't going to, not everybody's going to say, "Let's get those guys." Because the first few guys that got close to us were going to get hurt.
Right.
And they realized that. So they just stayed at bay, and we were able to get the girls
nice.
Out.
Nice.
Yeah.
That was it.
Heroes.
Bravo.
I love it.
Well, we got the water bed. So.
Yeah.
Oh, God. All right. So we're shifting slightly towards, okay, we're at the end of your experience at UCLA. Why do you think that y'all's friendship has stood the test of time?
That's interesting. That's a great question.
Thank you. I wrote them all.
We were always willing to share our booze.
Did you hear what Walter said?
No.
Say it.
We were always willing to share our booze.
Yeah. Go ahead, Richard.
But you weren't being drinking.
Well, I would have said we were always willing to share our blues.
Aww.
That too.
Come up with something.
That's sweet.
I don't know. I would say that I think we really had
compassion for each other. We listen to each other, you know? What you just said about sharing our blues. Because coming of age is tough. I mean, getting old's a tough too, but it's tough in a different way. Coming of age is not easy for anybody. You're trying to, especially if you're trying to be an artist. And we live in a very mercantile culture where, do you make money at it? Nope. Then you're not an artist, you know? And so we believed in each other.
We
saw talent in each other.
We had a common cause. We all wanted to get into the film business, but none of us really knew how. Mm. And I think we each had some kind of talent.
But so you only had talent to go on, not your parents buying you in and
all that. Oh, no, that's there was USC. None of that. I remember.
What do you say?
That's USC.
That's USC.
I remember the ceremony at UCLA when Bob was awarded that award up there, that Walter also received, Samuel Goldwyn, and
Writing
his
award.
Parents came. It was a big moment. His dad was dressed in a suit, and at the end, his dad said to Bob, "Bobby, this is really great, but what are you really going to do for a living?"
Oh.
Yeah, well, yeah, I understand why. You know,
come to the shoe store, Bob.
if there's no tradition in your family of the arts.
And that was it, you know.
Yeah. It's hard. I mean, it was just, might as well try to get to the moon to get into Hollywood. But
right.
So we stuck together and listened to each other's woes and advised each other and helped each other with give a leg up, a hand up, and all that stuff.
Y'all were also mirrors.
Pardon me?
You were mirrors for each other.
Mirrors?
Yeah. You told each other exactly what you thought.
Well, it is true. Yeah, there was no bullshit. I mean, we were... the only thing, sometimes we were filtering it through our own self-delusions, our insights about each other. But there was, you know, yeah, we definitely told each other what we thought and didn't bullshit each other.
Now, was that a unique type of friendship among men? Because I think from a perspective that is not, I can't say for sure, but what I see of a lot of male friendships is it's hard to be that deep as y'all are.
Well, maybe because we're artists, it makes it just a little easier.
There was something unique about it. But I
think it's unusual.
Yeah, it's really special.
I can't seem to keep my...
Well, what does Marissa say? Our daughter says, "Dad, you have a vagina."
Well, that's really nice, Diana.
No, I mean,
giving up my secrets.
He writes good women, and he don't know.
A new name, a lot of vagina.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's really great. It's gonna be in the archives.
You're sensitive. And you know. Dad, you have a vagina.
That was a shock on her wedding night. You know, no.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
No, but let me just say, it's not true. I actually
quite the
do not have a vagina.
Okay.
Next question.
For the record.
What do you think your greatest accomplishment is?
What do you think your greatest accomplishment is?
Oh, I'd have to say my kids.
Yeah, I don't know. I would say that for sure. Our kids have, you know, they're wonderful people. And I would also say that, you know, I think that the relationship I have with this woman is right up there with that. Because it's not easy to be, you know, 44 years together. Dear God! No, actually, it's good. It's good. And then I think, you know, in terms of just, I think being able to support my family with my writing, I was lucky and blessed because it's not easy to do that. And I wrote stuff, I'm not a household name, you know, I've won a few writing awards. I've made some movies that I'm really proud of, by the way, just a few.
Well,
the best movies of mine might still be screenplays that were never made. That's true of all of us.
Yeah.
They might be made yet once.
Yeah, well, The Great Debaters, Denzel Washington's movie about the black college debate team in the 1930s in East Texas that was the first to debate white colleges in the Deep South, and they ended up going undefeated, and they beat the national champs. That was a Golden Globe Best Picture nominee in 2008, and I got a Writers Guild Paul Selvin Award for it. But I'm very proud of that because it's got history in it and some soul. And, you know, there were a few others. But I'm going to, shall we put it on pause for a second?
Yep. So what would you like to say to Walter or about Walter?
Well, Walter's a great friend and... has always, we were neighbors. We live very close to each other. He used to unlock my back door. He has very long arms. He would put his arm in my cat door and unlock my door and do his laundry in my house. And I'll tell you a quick story. I have two stories. One day I came home from work and no one was home, and there was blood all the way down the back door. And I followed it out the back door. Remember our house in the back? So there were dripping blood all the way to Walter's house. And I thought, oh my God, they've killed each other. They've had one of their artistic disagreements and they freaking killed each other. I started calling all the hospitals, and I found them at Sentinella Hospital. And what happened was, in our old houses, we had glass doorknobs, and he had a door that was sticky, and he pulled on it, and the glass doorknob split and severely cut his tendons, and he wrapped it in a kitchen towel and ran over to Bob as it dripped all the way across our yards. We had one yard. Gosh. And they were, you know, by the time I got there, you know, he was loopy, and they, you know, they've been working on his hand.
Oh my God, they
yeah.
killed each other.
And another story was once when Nick was 3 years old and Bob was heavily working on a show called The Equalizer, and he was never home. I left my door open for 3 seconds and a man entered my house. Mm. He came in my front door, grabbed my purse, and went out my back door, and that's where I bumped into him. And when you look at somebody very quickly, you say, God, please make this be someone I know, and it wasn't. And basically, it worked out in my favor, but I took a chance. But anyway, I had to go to court. This kid had been on parole, and he was going back to jail, but Walter came with me. And he sat there with me, and it was just really great. You know, I couldn't really do it by myself, and Bob couldn't. So he's always been a great friend.
Walter Tenneau that the words he told me last week, that life is not an accomplishment, that it's an experience, will stay with me. Yeah. He's really, I think this is going to be a wonderful time for him. He's really, I think he's seen things that we normally don't get a chance to see, and he's experiencing almost an awareness of life, and I'm very happy that he's able to have this experience. This way. This is very hard. This is very hard. You know, we have an intellectual awareness of dying, but when we have the emotional awareness, we never understand exactly how we're going to react. And I think Walter's spending some time now looking at the roses, and he's looking at some of his poetry and looking at his life. And in retrospect, it's been good. He's had a good life.
Yeah, what would you like to say to Walter?
What I'd like to say to Walter is that, you know, I had read the reviews of his play Panhandle. I hadn't seen it yet, but I felt like I was in the presence of a person that had already been produced and reviewed in the LA Times. And when he read my first works and thought that they were damn good, he gave me confidence that I could do this. You know, he was, how old is he now? He's like 5 years older than me or something.
He was born in 42.
Okay, yeah, he's 6 years older than me. And I just felt, you know, that this is a man of real talent and deep intelligence, because he's very intelligent. And he had a published play then, Tapioca Misanthropa, which I didn't. And he read my work, and he just thought it was really fine. And that helps build you. The people that respond to your work, do you know what I mean?
My mother is going to be killed. Stop it. I would like for y'all to wait 1 minute.
Go out, Dinah, do belly dancing outside. It's
nice. Thank you.
Okay, should we start over?
No, we can't. It's not allowed on this app. You only have 4 minutes and 20 seconds.
Okay. Well, I mean, basically the thing that made me, to be birthed as a writer or any artist at all, you have to believe in yourself. And to believe in yourself, people that you respect, that you think have the real talent, they have to believe in you. Someone does. That's what's called mentorship. I wouldn't really say he was a mentor, because we were kind of at the same. He was older than me, but he'd been, you know, outside in the world, and I'm coming up through academia. I mean, not that I hadn't lived a little bit, but not as much as him. And, you know, so we were kind of co-equals at school. But because he had already been produced and published in that way, he was further along than I was. And, you know, and we kind of would critique each other's work and sort of mentor each other in the regard of craft. But in terms of kind of almost that spiritual or soulful value of, you know, do you have the spark? Mm-hmm. Do you have that, the muse? Is the muse speaking to you once in a while so that you're inspired and you're not just writing, you know, just, you know, redoing what other people have done before? And so he made me feel that. And that's a great gift. Also, I felt that myself and my loved ones are protected by his presence. And I think he felt the same of me, you know, that we would cover each other's backs mm-hmm. in the storm, you know, right. Whether it's financial or physical even, you know, or whatever, you know, that this is a guy that would stand by me and have my back.
Right.
And that's really important. And also just a funny dude that had and has, you know, a great sense of humor and a sense of, you know, wordsmithery. You know, there's very few that can pun like he can or play on words, you know. It's almost Shakespearean, that aspect of his writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say that those are the things that I remember and value. And got a hell of a lot of good laughs. And, you know, we would each have our little comedic sketches that we would, you know, do for each other, for groups of people. You know, my nephew Mark, who's about 53, I just communicated with him by text, and I told him that Walter was, you know, had cancer now, and it wasn't a good thing. And he just said, I love him, and I just remember, you know, so many great times being with him, because we would bring, you know, Mark and his young mm-hmm. wife over once in a while, and I think he was up in Santa Barbara when they lived in a different place, and he was always treated, you know, Walter always likes everybody to be, he likes everybody to come to his house, you know what I mean?
Right.
Even though you might end up doing the barbecue while he holds yeah. forth, you might end up washing the dishes, but he likes to open up his house to everybody, yeah. you know, so that's my Uncle Walter. I say Uncle Walter just as affection, he's not really my uncle, but there you have it.
Thank you.
Okay.